Okay, good evening. I think we should make a start to this, the pre-Christmas meeting of the Ulster Medical Society. So our speaker tonight is Professor Eileen Murphy, Professor of Archaeology in Queen's University Belfast. Eileen is a friend of mine over the years as well. She actually is a Queen's graduate, did her PhD in Queen's, and has been working in Queen's since 2000. She is a bioarchaeologist, and she's worked in Irish work and also in Russia and the Ukraine. She's published a number of books. I think the one that I pick out is Life and Death in Medieval Gaelic Ireland, the Ballyhanna Pass, but she's written other books. She's also the editor of an international journal which she founded, Childhood in the Past. So she has a fascinating background. This is her second lecture this week because she gave her inaugural lecture earlier on in the week. So she's had a very busy week. And on the basis of a theme for this year of diagnostics in the future, I thought it would be very interesting to look backwards the other way and how diagnostics can be applied to the past. And she agreed to talk about this, and therefore I'm delighted that she's going to talk about life and death in medieval Ireland, insights from paleopathology. Eileen.
Okay, thank you. That was a lovely introduction. And I'm delighted to be here, and I hope you enjoy this little journey into archaeology and what we can learn about the people from the past by looking at their remains. So just kind of why do we actually look at skeletons? So really we want to try to tell the stories of the people from the past. So like I kind of like to think about it like putting flesh back onto the bones of skeletons. So we're interested in learning about, you know, people's health status, what types of things they were eating, you know, what was their diet like, their lifestyle, because obviously they would have been a lot more physically active than many of us are in the world today. We look for evidence of things like violence, you know, and how much sort of conflict there was in different societies in the past. I'm very interested in emotion, because I think whenever you find the remains of the dead in burials, you always have to remember that it was the living that buried the dead, and you can look for evidence of emotional attachment in how people are laid out in their graves. Different religions have different ways of burying the dead. We can look for evidence of population movement, and this has got to be really exciting in recent years with sort of developments in ancient DNA analysis. And then perhaps of interest to this audience, we can also look for evidence of the evolution of infectious diseases like leprosy and tuberculosis, for example. So just a little bit about ethics, because obviously, archaeologists, we're very familiar with the fact that we deal with the dead and we look at human skeletal remains. But I just kind of wanted to make it clear, you know, we only disturb the dead when there's very good reason to do so. So it's usually tied into development. So in a lot of the skeletons that I've looked at over the years have come from road schemes. You know, the people haven't realised there was a cemetery, then the road has been sort of planned, and then they have to make the decision, do we continue with our original development and disturb the cemetery, or do we move the road? And quite often, it's not really possible to move the road. So we operate under a very highly regulated system with licences for all excavation, and then any of the destructive analysis we do as well has to be licensed, so it's all properly recorded and approved. Like I say, I think it's important because we give a voice to the people of the past and we tell their stories. And the history books are full of the elite, the great and the good of society, whereas the people that we encounter in these cemeteries are the ordinary members of society. You know, and people like the kids who don't really have a voice in history books. I also think we can't really understand the present and prepare for the future if we don't learn from the past. And this applies to the whole discipline of archaeology and also paleoecology, which is what we also do here in Queen's, which is the study of past environments and the impact of people on the environments. And then for my work tied into that is knowledge of diseases and their evolution. So I'm very aware this is an audience of doctors and medical people. So I hope what I say isn't too simplistic, and I'm looking forward to kind of hearing your thoughts about, you know, some of my identifications as at the end of the lecture. So I just kind of wanted to start by actually explaining how do we categorise diseases, you know, in terms of paleopathology. So it's probably a lot more simplistic than the terms you would use, but in general terms we would look for metabolic diseases, so, you know, evidence of physiological stressors, and we would look for things like crib orbitalia, enamel hypoplasia, Harris lines. We would also then lump in deficiency diseases like vitamin C deficiency, vitamin D deficiency into that, evidence of anemia. We would look for evidence for congenital or developmental diseases. Normally we tend to find lots of evidence for very kind of minor sort of occult defects that wouldn't really have been of any consequence to the skeleton or to the person, but sometimes we do find, you know, more serious developmental diseases, and I'm going to show you some examples of cases like this from medieval Ireland in my talk. We find lots of evidence of degenerative diseases. So sometimes we can get evidence of conditions like DISH or ankylosing spondylitis. But mostly it's osteoarthritis, and again, it's sort of due to the sort of arduous physical existence of people in the past. Neoplastic disease would be amongst the rarer types of lesions we encounter, and we were just talking about that earlier. And basically, I think it's because people in the past tended to die at a lot younger age than people in the present. We find quite a lot of evidence of trauma, so this can be everyday sort of accidents. We also then would categorise weapon injuries and evidence of violence under trauma, and also surgical procedures, the most common of which would be trepanation, and I'll show you an example of that. Infectious disease, we look at non-specific infection, and these are sort of lesions that are caused by any of the sort of the pyogenic bacteria, as opposed to the specific infective diseases like leprosy, tuberculosis and treponemal disease. So talk about that as well. And dental diseases, so we would look for, you know, caries formation, calculus, abscesses, you know, all the things that modern people suffer from. And that's really helpful for informing us about diet, you know, because depending on the types of lesions that you find in a population in the past, you usually can work out, you know, were they eating very much a sort of an animal protein-based diet or more of a carbohydrate cereal-based diet, which tend to cause caries. And then we can augment, you know, our morphological analysis with using techniques like stable isotope analysis, which also then helps us learn about diet. But I'm not going to talk about dental disease any further. So I just thought, like, in an archaeological lecture, we're very much about context, and we always want to set the scene, you know, for sort of to help people understand, you know, who we're actually studying. So I'm going to be talking quite a lot about people from these two sites in my talk. So one of the populations is from Ranala, which was a site that was excavated only in the last couple of years. And we've been studying this population just across the road over in archaeology until very recently. We're about to kind of move into the sort of writing up phase. So Ranala was discovered as part of a road scheme. So the funder was Roscommon County Council and Transport Infrastructure Ireland. And whenever they excavated the cemetery, they found the remains of almost 600 people. So there was 170 adults and then a very high proportion of children, 387. So we would say that this population dates to mostly the early medieval phase. So it starts off in the mid-6th century. So it's, you know, there's some of the burials even extend back to sort of the transitional period, you know, from paganism to Christianity, but mostly early medieval. And then this is basically the site. This is an aerial view. This is a plan. And you can see it's what we would call a settlement cemetery because there's lots of evidence of kind of industry and sort of domestic activity. But then this kind of purple wedge is where there was a burial phase of activity. And we do tend to find these types of sites across Ireland where the living and the dead seem to be kind of coexisting almost in the same sort of settlement. And it was surrounded by different ditches at different phases. So the fact that it's kind of this sort of wedge shape, is this sort of strip, is a reflective of the fact that there was a road. Then the second site is Ballyhanna. So it's located over in the far west of Donegal, so it's in Ballyshannon. And again, it was another road scheme, and it was a cemetery that had been totally forgotten. You know, it is, we always find it quite sort of surprising that you've got these large-scale sites with hundreds of burials, and they've been totally forgotten in local memory. So Ballyhanna was actually a churchyard site So you can see here's the plan of the church, and then you can see the density of burials around it. So again, because it was a road scheme, it was funded by Donegal County Council and the National Roads Authority. And this is slightly later, so our main burial phase would be AD 1200 to 1650. So the two sites basically straddle pretty much the entirety of the medieval period. And this was a very sort of compressed, deep burial ground, and there were almost 1,300 individuals, this time more adults than children. And most of the people buried in these two sites, you know, followed the sort of typical Christian pattern. So they were extended, so basically lying on, extended and supine, so they were lying on their backs with their arms and legs out straight, just as modern Christians are buried today. And their heads would be to the west, so that's the kind of typical configuration. And you can see just from this slide, you know, they were just buried straight into the earth, into earthen pits, and sometimes people had a shroud around them, and then other times they were just put directly into the ground. So I'm going to kind of jump between the two populations depending on what we're actually talking about, but I'm going to start by looking at Ranelagh and some of the evidence for the children in particular, because I was quite surprised that the sort of what the babies aged between a month and a year were actually very unhealthy in the Ranelagh population, or certainly had lots of lesions. So, but this is just to sort of show you how the population was split. It was almost like a third adults, a third children, and then a third babies. So little kids less than a year old, and then our children are 1 to 18. So we had a couple of examples where you had babies in utero. So the very, very youngest members of society, lots of small children, slightly older children, all the way up to adults and some older adults, although our archaeological age determination methods are a bit crude. So we would call an old person 50 plus in our populations because we don't really have the techniques to be able to identify the old, the 70s and 80 year old people, even though we know, you know, from historical sources and grave memorials, etc., that they probably would have been there. So looking at the children then, so this is the under 18s, we would call them the juveniles. So you can see kind of from the profile that most of the children died between a month and a year of age. So this was quite unusual because you'd expect, you know, higher numbers of sort of newborns, because this, you know, you'd expect this to be the most sort of vulnerable time in a young child's life. But for whatever reason, it was the 1 month to 1 year olds. Now, other populations I've looked at, you get a peak in age of death between 1 and 6. And this again, I kind of think that you can explain this just by the natural behaviour of toddlers, you know, because things like accidents would be invisible to us. But we've got, you know, coroner's records from places like medieval England that talk about, you know, little kids pulling pots on themselves or falling into the fire or even just going outside their house and getting run over by a pig, you know. So there's lots of kind of discussion about accidents. But this was quite a curious profile to me. And whenever we actually sort of looked at the skeletons, there was sort of some evidence for why this may be the case. And I'm going to just look at that in a minute. But I thought some of you might be quite interested in, you know, how we're interpreting our pregnant women and unborn babies. So I just put in two of the cases. So, I mean, you all know that in the modern world, modern maternal deaths in developing countries, you know, they're caused by hemorrhaging, you know, hypertensive disorders, sepsis, infection, obstructed labour and unsafe abortions. Now, in terms of archaeological pregnant women, it can be very difficult for us to really identify why, you know, a pair may have died. But we do tend to find that it is usually at or around term. And I've seen some examples where we might be able to say, you know, it could be examples of shoulder dystocia, for example, because you can see that the little shoulder blade of the baby kind of lodged against the mother's pelvis. But so this is our two examples from Ranelagh, and you can see basically that the baby's head is face down in this young woman. We would age the baby at about 38 weeks just by looking at the tooth development and the lengths of the long bones, and you can see it's kind of an oblique lie, but the mother's pubic symphysis bones are still fairly closed. I mean, they're a little bit broken, but we would still say they're quite closed, because some of the women that we think maybe died during delivery, you can see the pubic bones are very widely spread apart. This is quite an interesting example because we were able to augment the analysis with ancient DNA. So again, we had a young adult mother. The DNA showed that the baby was actually male, because in children's skeletons, until they reach puberty, we can't tell if it's a little boy or a little girl. This little person's very poorly preserved, but you can still see the little cranial bones here and then some of the long bones. So the head is down again, ready for delivery. What was interesting was that the mother of the baby had no relatives within the other skeletons from Ranelagh who had had their DNA determined, whereas the baby had three relatives. So you kind of, we can then look at population movement. So it looks like the mother was a blow-in to that particular site, whereas the baby was connected. So maybe the baby's father was somebody who had been living in that community. So just sticking with our preterms and neonates, we had 12 preterm infants, and because their little bones are so tiny, it's quite rare to find those in archaeological contexts. But all of them died during the third trimester of pregnancy, and the very youngest preterm baby we had was about 29 gestational weeks. And then we had 34 full-term neonatal babies. So the fact that the babies are buried on their own, we can sort of presume that the mothers survived. We had two cases of little twins, and you do find twins occurring sporadically in archaeological sites, and presumably because twin deliveries are, you know, difficult even in the modern world. So here's one little twin, and then the other twin here is not so well preserved. And you can see a bit more clearly, there's a little femur of one baby and then the pair of femora of the other. But this one was quite poignant because it looked like the little hands were certainly overlapped or touching or entwined. So we are assuming again that there was a connection between those two babies. Now, sometimes whenever we do DNA, we're surprised and it isn't. The babies aren't actually related and it's us putting our own interpretation on them. But without that, you know, we have to kind of, we can sort of assume that they're the same size pretty much, and they're buried at the same time, so the likelihood is that they were twins. Okay, so anyway, going back to this whole idea of population stress, and we would call it, you know, like physiological stress. So I had said about the babies between a month and a year, you know, being a very high proportion of those that have died. And this age group as well displayed a lot of stunted growth. So the way we can determine that is, you know, working out the children's age based on their teeth, which are considered to be less susceptible to environmental stressors, and then comparing the age that we would get from the lengths of their long bones with the body, the postcranial skeleton being considered to be more susceptible to, you know, stress and malnutrition. So we were finding that in 84.7%, we had basically the dental age was older than the long bone lengths. And we would find that there was even as much as, you know, 7 or 8 weeks difference between the two different age methods. This is a bit basic, but basically what this is showing is kind of sort of average heights depending on age for a number of different populations. So the Ranelagh population that we're talking about is the one in pink. And again, you can kind of see that the younger babies, the neonates, seem to be, you know, up of around the sort of the right size, what you'd expect in other populations, and even a little bit bigger. But then as we move forward into the 1.5-year-olds or one month to 1-year-olds, they start to get a bit smaller. So there seems to be something happening to make this particular age group very physiological stressed. And we were looking at, it's a technique called dental incremental analysis, and it's basically looking at nitrogen and carbon isotopes in teeth, but doing it incrementally so you can see changes over time. And this was then also sort of showing evidence of very high nitrogen levels, which we would again interpret as high levels of physiological stress. So what also seemed to be happening in this age group was there were a lot of lesions that we would identify as being caused by vitamin C and vitamin D deficiency. So, 37% of babies had sort of lesions suggestive of one or other or both. And I've never really come across any of the populations that I've studied that had this high proportion. So the way we can interpret this is that, you know, there must have been a lot of malnutrition in terms of the vitamin C, and then potentially a lack of sunlight in terms of the vitamin D. Now, we know from the sort of the annals of Ulster and different kind of documentary sources that these people were very susceptible to natural disasters, you know, and they talk, you know, about famines, you know, animal disease, different environmental events, all of that would have put the populations at risk and then potentially, you know, caused malnourishment. So, for example, the Annals of Ulster talk about in AD 764, it was a year of excessive snowfall, drought and famine, talked about dysentery flourished, and presumably that was because people, you know, that were starving, they were going to be more susceptible to these particular diseases. And then it said the young, old and the weak were particularly vulnerable. So the way we identify scurvy, we look for sort of signs of hemorrhaging and bleeding, and this is the sphenoid, and around the foramen rotundum is one of the kind of the sites that we would look at. So you get kind of grey bone. Now, it can be very difficult when you're dealing with babies to be able to say, you know, is this normal bone growth or is this pathological? But whenever you see the sort of the distinct concentrations and the patches of the grey bone, we would consider that pathological, along with other features. So you also look for things like you get lots of grey bone formation around sort of the supraorbital ridges here, lots of grey bone on the parietal, and then there's patches here on the occipital. And another telltale sign would be this kind of extreme thickening that we get at the lateral orbits. So a lot of the babies had these patterns of lesions. So it seemed very odd to be having vitamin C deficiency in young babies, you know, babies less than a year, because we imagined they would have been breastfeeding and that would have been their best chance of survival. And the isotopic information again suggested that they were being breastfed. So this caused me quite a lot of conundrum, because I would be a big breastfeeding fan, and I know that even in famine conditions today that mothers are still encouraged to breastfeed their babies because that's their best chance of survival. So this is something I'd be very interested to hear your views on. Now, I came across one reference that made me think, you know, could mothers have sort of subclinical scurvy? Because we weren't finding evidence in the adults. And then that was causing the deficiencies in the babies. So Dr. Norris Wilkinson in 1921, he described what he thought was a case of scurvy in a purely breastfed baby of a few months of age. But interestingly, he described the mother as a strong, stout, healthy country woman and blamed her diet of pickles, vinegar and bread as the cause of the baby's condition. And then he said that a change to the woman's diet caused the baby to recover. So this is kind of going against what I've always believed, but I'm very interested to sort of hear what the medical views might be on this. In terms of rickets, it used to be in paleopathology that we were always looking for bending deformities. But now we've got a whole suite of different tools that we can identify rickets in young children. And it's all to do with kind of, you know, a lack of mineralisation and, you know, poorly formed bones. And again, you know, rickets, vitamin D deficiency, it can be, you know, partly due to diet, but it is more considered to be due to a lack of sunlight. So is this again then going back to this notion of sort of poor weather conditions that we're getting in the famine? Or in the Annals of Ulster? And is it the case that if you had a sickly child, a sickly malnourished child, you were more likely to keep them indoors to protect them? But then because their houses would have been very dark with no windows, that this then led on to potential rickets. So this is just one of the cases. This is a little 7.5-month-old baby. So that's the skeleton laid out. You can see the epiphyses are very flattened. There's also like a sort of a tick form, like an angulation of the epiphyses, and it's very pronounced usually in the larger long bones. You can see the bone is really poor quality. You also get like patches of new bone formation. You get fraying of the ribs, and you get this kind of like a cupping at the ends of the sternal ends of the ribs. So to me, this was quite a classical case of, you know, infant rickets. We also then found sort of traces of rickets in the older children, but this could be residual from their babyhood. So there were 12 possible cases, and they're a bit more kind of what you'd expect, like a bit more sort of curvature. And then again, you can kind of see this sort of ticking at the distal end of the femur. And you get then sort of torsion in some of the bones. So you can see this kind of twisting deformity in the femora. So it was in the babies very much so, some cases in the children, but only a sort of a scattering amongst the adults. So that's why I think this is whatever's happening to cause this sort of these metabolic diseases in these children. It's very much when they are small, and then if they survive it, they tend to go on to reach adulthood. So moving on just to the adults then, I just wanted to kind of just sort of introduce what was their sort of demographic profile. So it was quite unusual, this site, in that we would normally expect, you know, 50-50 men, women, but you can see here that women predominate. and men are only about, you know, a third. So we actually think this might be tied into sort of changing burial practices, and that it seems to be as the site kind of moves forward in time, and it could be that the men simply, you know, started to be buried maybe in a local churchyard, whereas the women preferred to use the traditional burial ground. But this is something we're still exploring. But I thought you might be interested in the sort of the size of the people. So the average height of a Ranelagh woman would have been about 5'2", so a bit smaller than a modern Irish adult, Irish woman. And the same with the average adult male stature at Ranelagh, about 5'7". So they weren't really small, but they were a little bit smaller. And, you know, people don't realise that, you know, we do find really tall people in the past, like quite a lot of the Antrim populations I've looked at, for example. You know, there's always like a couple of 6 foot tall men. In terms of age of death, so we have quite crude methods when it comes to adult age of death. With children, because we can look at their teeth and we can look at sort of epiphyseal fusion and the lengths of the long bones, we can, you know, give the age to maybe a few months or a year or two. But with adults, we put them into, you know, quite broad brackets. So our young adults are 18 to 35, middle-aged 35 to 40, 35 to 50, and then old 50 plus. So this population, you can see, you know, quite a lot of people actually survive to middle age. So again, this is making me think that the adult population is relatively healthy compared to the child population. So what about the adult health then? There's lots of evidence of an arduous existence. So we would just call this sort of degenerative joint disease. You know, so you get, for example, these are just some examples to give you a little flavour. You know, fused digits. You get, I mean, this person's got like eburnation and pitting in their carpals, so kind of arthritis of the wrist. We've got Schmorl's nodes here, so you can see it's basically when the sort of the disc sort of bursts in between the vertebrae. Osteoarthritis, you've got sort of lipping here, and then sort of pitting at the sort of rotator cuff muscles. And then this is the distal end of the ulna. And again, you can see sort of pitting and osteophytic lipping. And over here is an example just where you've got, I think it's a couple of thoracic vertebrae. And again, you've got like porosity on the bodies. So these are all, this is very common in archaeological population. And almost all of the adults had some sort of osteoarthritis in a different part of their body. But what was interesting was that the young adults in the population also had these sort of degenerative lesions. So it's all just pointing towards them having, you know, an arduous sort of physical existence from a young age. And that's not at all surprising because, you know, today we just go to Tesco's, buy our groceries, we're fine. We live in houses that somebody else makes for us. But in the past, they'd have had to build their own houses. Anything they wanted to eat, they'd have had to either grow or they'd have had to raise the animals and then process all the products. So life would have been really, you know, heavy going and put a lot of pressure potentially on joints of the body. And then sort of following on from this, we got quite a lot of injuries. And this is, again, sort of typical because these people would have been farmers. So, you know, you can imagine lots of everyday sort of accidents. So we had, 46 adults, so that's about, nearly a third, displayed minor injuries. But there were some more serious injuries. So we had fractured ribs. So here's an example of one that didn't heal, you know, before the person died. So you can see, like, the break is still very clear. And then there's kind of this grey pitted bone around the sort of the site of the fracture. Two hip fractures, fractured elbow, and then several finger fractures. And hand fractures seem to be very common in past medieval populations. And again, I suppose this is because they were using their hands for everything. So I thought you'd be interested in these hip fractures. So this was an old adult male, and he had a long-standing hip fracture. So you can see basically the acetabulum and all has been completely remodeled, and like half of the femoral head has kind of stayed detached. So he also had a fractured tibia. So we kind of think that possibly a heavy fall would have caused an injury like this. You know, and again, if you think about it, you know, people having to, you know, climb up tops of trees or up to the roofs of their houses or whatever to construct them. So we do get a lot of falling injuries. And then if they were involved in any sort of horse riding, again, this is a typical sort of falling injury that we might find. This was the other hip fracture. So this time it was an old age female, and she had a long-standing hip fracture. So you can see basically that the femoral head stayed detached from the neck of the femur. She also had very light bones and extensive osteoarthritis. So whenever you kind of get this patterning, we can suspect that she might have had type 2 osteoporosis, although we would need to do kind of more sort of bone density tests, etc., just to confirm that diagnosis. This is just an example from Ballyhanna, which is another sort of serious traumatic injury. So this is skeleton 606, so he's a middle-aged male. And you can see that the femoral head here has basically, so it's like a fracture dislocation at the left hip, and the femoral head has kind of burst through the obturator foramen. So, you know, that probably would have caused some damage to, you know, the internal kind of pelvic organs potentially and structure. But it's difficult to see it maybe in this view, but whenever you sort of reconstruct the bones, his leg would have been sort of permanently flexed at 90 degrees. So he certainly would have been immobile, you know, for a couple of months following the injury. And the rest of his skeleton, the bones were quite sort of gracile and light. So we would suggest that might be to do with sort of, you know, the fact that he didn't use his bones and he was sort of, they're becoming atrophied because he was more of an invalid and he was physically impaired because of this this dislocation fracture. So I mean, this isn't medical, but I thought you might be interested, you know, because like I said at the start, within our kind of repertoire of trauma, we also include, you know, violence and weapon trauma. So at Ranala, we had 6 cases of weapon trauma, and it was in 5 adults and 1 child, and all of them were male, including the child, it was a little boy. The adults were kind of young adults and middle-aged adults, which is sort of what you'd expect in terms of, you know, who were going to be the fighters and the warriors in a society. They were all robust, so again, that's kind of what you might expect. And in 5 cases, there was definite evidence of decapitation. So this is skeleton 290. So you can see him in situ, and you can see that basically his neck is slightly misaligned from his skull. So they've made an attempt to basically put his head back into, you know, into the grave along with his body, but they've got it slightly skewed. You can see kind of the slicing marks here, and as sort of his atlas and the axis, the peg has been totally removed. And interestingly, the back of his mandible, the angle, has been totally sliced through. So that would suggest that it was like a formal execution, and had the blows had been dealt from behind, possibly when his neck was hyperflexed forward. And we've got, you know, drawings and accounts of what the Irish warriors in medieval times would have done. So we know that they used axes, and, you know, we know that execution was sort of part of what they did, you know, and that involved decapitation. This is a child. Now, this really shocked us. We were, you know, because it's one thing, we normally do find, you know, a couple of examples, maybe of teenagers or adult males. But to find, you know, a child at 7.5 to 9.5 was a complete shock to all of us. So again, you can see the vertebrae, you've got the clear cuts through. You can see there's been multiple cuts, so it wasn't like a clean blow. And the damage to the mandible is sort of, because the mandible in a child is a lot thinner, it's caused the bones to sort of detach and separate apart. And you can see this is the little boy in situ. And again, you know, they've tried to sort of reconstruct his body and put his head back on. So because we think he, again, had been dealt a blow from behind. So why would you do that to a child? You know, it's unlikely, and from the sort of the legislation from this time period, we know that there was, I think it's not until they were about 13 that was considered to be the age of reason. So a child like this shouldn't really have been answerable for any crime. So my suspicion is that he could have been the child of somebody important, and that what better way to get at a parent than to kill the child. So the prevalence of violent death at Ranelagh was about 3%. So that's kind of similar to what we find in other early medieval sites. There's only one site called Oam Bristie where you've got really sky-high rates of violence, and that seems to have been definitely involved with some sort of a battle. And I thought you might be interested in this. This is an example of trepanation from Ballyhanna. So you probably all heard of trepanation before, yeah. So basically, we encounter this quite a lot in the archaeological record. It can go back, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And basically, it involves removing a roundel of skull. And it would have been undertaken, you know, using a variety of techniques like scraping, maybe with a seashell or sharp stone like a flint. And then this kind of progressed through to the sort of the trephines that we know were used in sort of post-medieval times. And I think in Dublin there was a lot of these trephines were developed, and it was a real sort of centre of excellence in the early modern period. So at Ballyhanna, we had one skeleton, a young woman, and you can see she's had a large chunk of the top of her skull removed. But the fact that it's quite sort of irregular, the margins are quite irregular, suggests that there was healing, and you can see the bone's quite striated as well. So she did survive for quite a period of time after this operation, because quite often the holes stay quite open, you know, and the bone doesn't really infill again fully, or if it does, it's like quite a thin shell. And this is just, I mean, I'm sure you guys have all seen trepanations before, but this is an example that we would find in paleopathology textbooks. And it's a guy from East Africa who had undergone multiple of these operations and obviously, you know, lived to tell the tale. Now, we also get sort of artistic depictions. So this is from a 12th century medical treatise. And I just think it's really interesting because it kind of what we call like the phenomenology of the process, because you can see, you know, there's a doctor and his attendant. One's holding back the presumably the scalp, and then the other's doing the scraping. But if you look at the face of the person being operated on, you know, they look a bit stupefied, as if they've been drugged, which you'd kind of hope. And you can see that their arms are tied behind their back, and there's even, you know, the attendant has his foot on the patient's foot, because obviously the stiller you stayed, the better your chances of survival. And other sorts of ways that they would have sort of cured themselves or treated illness in the past, in medieval times, would have been through the use of holy wells, you know, and these are still extant in modern times. So we know that in the sort of the Donegal area, there was at least 106 holy wells, and 8 of these were in the vicinity of Ballyshannon. So it's kind of interesting to imagine, you know, some of these people actually go into these wells to drink kind of curative properties in the water. So with our young woman, she also had severe chronic osteomyelitis in her left femur, and this also then was evidence of this in her spine. But we don't know which came first. You know, did she have this infection and then they decided to trepan her to try to heal her? Or did she get an infection introduced to her body through the trepanation and then this sort of spread in the bloodstream and caused this infection in her leg and her spine? And unfortunately, that's not, we can't really answer that through paleopathology. This is the only example of a neoplastic disease that I've encountered in an Irish population, and to be honest, in the Russian populations I've studied, I've also only encountered one, and it's again been what we think is metastatic carcinoma. So this was a skull. It's quite often the case, you know, if you've got, you know, somebody whose body is ravaged by disease, they're not particularly well preserved because there's been so much sort of destruction, you know, through the disease processes to the skeleton. So we only had this young woman's skull, and you can see she had these osteolytic lesions, sort of, there were 9 of them all together, and they were a variety of different shapes. But you can see that there's also an element of sort of bone formation, you know, around one of these lesions. So this then made us think that it's, you know, potentially, because they're lytic lesions, potentially she had a primary tumour of the breast or the lung. And because the breast is the one that the clinical literature would suggest is more frequently associated with lytic lesions, we kind of opted for that. You know, did she have breast cancer? So a differential diagnosis would be multiple myeloma. But again, the clinical text would suggest you don't get reactive bone formation with that condition. So that's why we're opting for it being a metastatic carcinoma. So there was a paper from the 1960s which really documented 250 cases of women with untreated breast cancer. So that they, those types of cases then help us to sort of reconstruct, you know, what life might have been like for people like this young woman. So she may have sort of lived for another 3 years, because that's sort of the mean duration of life from the onset of symptoms without any treatment. But it's very unlikely that she would have survived past 5 years. So it's quite grim, you know, if you think about today and people's, you know, potential survival rates in the past without treatment. It was something quite different. So specific infective diseases in the past they can be very, very interesting, because as well as, you know, causing obviously quite distinct lesions to the skeletons, there's usually a whole sort of social response as well. So tuberculosis is one of the diseases like I've encountered quite frequently in Irish medieval populations. And at Ranelagh, there were 5 children and 3 adults. So this was already, you know, 2.5% sort of prevalence rate as opposed to, you know, your typical sort of 1%. And also the fact if you get lesions in children, that can often sort of hint that the disease was actually quite rampant in a population. And again, this is sort of looking at sort of information from places like India, which would still suffer from the disease. And you can kind of look at the age when children might be most susceptible to the disease or not. And in archaeological populations, we tend to kind of find different patterns compared to modern, with children of all ages affected. So we also found at Ranelagh a possible case of brucellosis, and this is something I think as paleopathologists we still don't quite understand the skeletal manifestations, because again, you know, the sort of historical sources suggest that brucellosis should have been rampant in medieval Ireland and the cattle should have been full of it. But I think we sometimes mix up tuberculosis and brucellosis in our identifications. When another person had a systemic infection, but most were simply kind of isolated cases in one bone in a person. But I wanted to show you a couple of quite extreme examples. So this is an adolescent, so an older teenager. So they had kind of evidence of hypoplasia in their teeth, sort of suggestive, you know, of poor sort of health. They had heavy calculus, but they had sort of lots of kind of lytic lesions throughout their skeleton. So you can see this is at the sternal ends of a pair of ribs, this massive kind of cavity. And then this is at the elbow as well, a massive cavity. So ordinarily, wouldn't necessarily think that that was sort of typical of tuberculosis. But we had other individuals then with similar lesions and also then more kind of classic signs of tuberculosis. So this is a female teenager. So we got DNA undertaken on her, and that was how we were able to say for certainty that it was a girl. And you can see she's buried in quite an unusual position. So her feet are kind of right up against her buttocks and her hands are kind of up against her face, you know, like she's praying. But if you can see in the photograph, her tibia both had these massive lytic lesions. So you can see it's particularly big on the left. And initially we weren't sure what was happening, but the more sort of research we did, the more it looks like she had cystic tuberculosis. And, you know, her clavicles, her ribs, her mandible, her body was completely ravaged, and it's very probable that the disease, you know, contributed to her death. So cystic form of tuberculosis, I'm kind of wondering, is it something that we find in earlier skeletons, and then as we move through the medieval period, you're more likely to get Pott's disease of the spine? So it's just a bit of a notion I have, because like I hadn't seen tuberculosis like this before in any of the later medieval groups that I've looked at. But this is another example. So this is a young adult female. And you can see she's got like lytic lesions in her pelvic bones, but she's also got the more classic kind of Pott's disease and the collapse of the body of the vertebra. So in these populations, you know, it's quite possible that they did suffer from the animal form of the disease. And you know, because we know they were going to be eating lots of meat and drinking milk from cows, you obviously wouldn't have had any sort of protection against the bacteria. Now, the only problem with this was that colleagues over in England, they undertook a study of skeletons from Warren Percy. So it was an English village. And again, they were looking at the DNA of the tuberculosis pathogen, and they assumed that it was going to be, again, animal form of the disease, but it turned out to be the Mycobacterium tuberculosis as opposed to bovis. So it was human-to-human infection. So it sort of suggests that even in these kind of rural communities where you might think the population's not particularly dense, that people were able to kind of cough over each other and spread the disease and transmit it that way. So we're sort of still hoping to look at tuberculosis and look at the pathogen DNA in the Ranelagh people. That's a project that's on the horizon. So another specific infective disease that's of great interest in Ireland is leprosy. And this is something I actually couldn't believe when I did my master's all those years ago, that leprosy was an epidemic disease in medieval times. And I took a year out from my PhD kind of unofficially and went off and did some excavation up around Antrim. And again, it was all sort of development work. And we dug inside the church at St. Patrick's in Armoy because they were renovating the church. So this was the scene. And lo and behold, we discovered the first case of leprosy in an archaeological skeleton from Ireland. So you can see the feet. That was all that was preserved, just this person's feet. And you can see the toes are all like, the diaphyses are all really sort of sort of point that we call this kind of the sucked candy appearance, and it's kind of all to do with its acro-osteolysis. You can see sort of dorsal tarsal exostoses and lots of kind of different lesions due to infection. There's like a sinus here, and this person's foot, that's all that's left of the kind of the sort of phalanges. It's the only phalanges left, and the metatarsals would be basically, you know, just down to sort of half a foot. So that person had, we suspect, the most serious form of tuberculosis or of leprosy, the lepromatous form. But typically we would need the facial part of the skeleton to be able to identify that. So whenever this person was radiocarbon dated, they turned out to be quite late. So it was AD 1445 to 1637. And this kind of, in the broader scheme of things, would be when we would imagine leprosy would be going into decline, because leprosy and tuberculosis are sort of sister diseases. And as tuberculosis took hold in a place, leprosy sort of died out. So it's quite interesting that there was still somebody with leprosy up in Armoy at that time. And leprosy is one of these diseases that evoked great fear, basically because people could see it really destroyed the body and were terrified of it. So people who had the disease were sort of treated like social outcasts. They had to wear special clothing. They had to have a bell or a clapper and warn other people. And there was a whole list of prohibitions put in place to keep them ostracised and to protect the living. And I think it was a lawyer, a guy, Gerald Lee, he documented Irish leprosy hospitals from medieval times, and he worked out there was probably about 50. You know, he was able to find, you know, different sort of documentary accounts suggestive of this. So that again gives us an indication that there probably was quite a lot of people with leprosy in Ireland at that time, although how reliable their identifications would have been, you know, and maybe there were other skin diseases that were still being considered as leprosy. But the thing I found really hard about it was that a person with leprosy, as well as being outcast, they basically had the ceremony that was said over a deceased corpse said over them. So they were brought to the church, the priest made them lie down, they put a black trestle over them, and they threw earth on top of them and basically said, you know, be thou dead to the world, and then they were cast out. So it was a really horrific social response. So that was 1998. Fast forward to 2008. And colleagues down in Dublin, they discovered another three cases of leprosy in a development context at a place called Golden Lane, which is right in the city centre. So we got together a small British Academy grant, and we looked at the bones, we looked at the ancient DNA of the pathogens, and then we looked at the sort of isotopes and then the archaeological and historical context. So just to sort of talk you through, this is a teenager, so probably male. We didn't have the human DNA analysis undertaken on him, so we can't say that for certain, but the skeletal characteristics are suggestive that he was male. You can see there's some damage to the toes. They're starting to sort of resorb away, and there's lots of patches of kind of grey bone formation, so all sort of suggestive of infectious. And whenever you get it on the feet, then that's again kind of a bit of a telltale with that it was leprosy. So in terms of the pathogen DNA, it was weakly positive for leprosy, but the DNA was too fragmented for really this to be developed. But the strontium and oxygen isotopes were interesting because these tell us about, you know, the sort of underlying geology and the water, the drinking water that a person would have ingested when they were a child and their teeth were forming. So these indicated that he may have been Scandinavian when he was a child, and he may have lived somewhere in Scandinavia. So that was interesting. And then the pattern sort of seemed to repeat itself with the two other individuals. So you can see this is a middle-aged man, and this time he had really classic sort of signs of lepromatous leprosy. So you can see the sort of the central incisors are lost, and the alveolar bone has been eroded away, and the nasal spine is all gone, and the nasal aperture is widened. You can see again there's kind of diaphyseal remodeling of this particular metatarsal. And some loss of digits. So it was quite classic in terms of osteology. And his DNA was particularly well preserved. So it revealed that it was a type 3-1 leprosy pathogen. So I'm going to talk about what that means in a minute. And again, his strontium isotopes and oxygen isotopes were interesting and suggested that he had grown up in coastal southern Norway. And then the last person was another middle-aged male, and you can see he's got a typical Christian burial, but he's got earmuffs, which is just a little variant that we find in medieval skeletons. He had facial lesions again, so suggestive of lepromatous, a massive perforation in his palate, and he also had this ulcer on his forehead. So that wouldn't be particularly typical of leprosy, but when you've got sort of the perforation in the palate and sort of lesions in the feet, it's probably part of the sort of the spectrum. And his oxygen suggested that he might have actually been Irish, but the strontium suggested that he could have been kind of North Irish or from Wales or Britain. And he had very well preserved pathogen, leprosy pathogen DNA, but it was a completely different strain. It was type 2F. So what does this all mean then? So we had two separate branches of the leprosy phylogenetic tree. So that was a bit of a surprise. So this map shows you, you know, the different strains that have been found in archaeological skeletons. And these strains then coexisted in 12th, 13th century Dublin. So the type 3 one, that's the one that we would find mostly in sort of Scandinavian and British skeletons with leprosy. So now there's been a sort of a new hypothesis put forward recently, because this strain of leprosy is actually found in modern red squirrels. So they've still got like the strain that medieval people would have suffered from. So now there's a thought that perhaps the medieval fur trade was actually might have contributed to the spread of leprosy in medieval times. So that was quite interesting because I hadn't realised that poor squirrels could get leprosy at all. And then the type 2F, this seems to have migrated from the Middle East to India and Southeast Asia and then kind of evolved into the type 1 strains. So today you would find it in places like Turkey and Iran. So basically, you know, sometimes people think that Ireland, you know, we're an island. We wouldn't have been particularly well connected in medieval times in the past. But, you know, through this disease evidence, it suggests that Dublin and Ireland probably were really well connected, you know, with people coming in from all sorts of places and then bringing, you know, pathogens with them. So we basically now have come up with the idea that the disease probably was part of the Viking legacy. And the reason for this is because the strontium and oxygen isotopes, you know, they showed us that we had two of the individuals grew up in Scandinavia and then one was a Northern Irish British person. We know that the Vikings arrived in Dublin in the AD 840s. So we all know that they brought, you know, towns, currency, all these great things to Ireland. But the question is, you know, did they actually bring leprosy here as well? So moving on then from infectious disease, I just wanted to show an example of a genetic disease, so a developmental. So in Ballyhanna, we had two individuals with a condition called multiple osteochondromas. Now, this is officially one of the rare diseases because of its prevalence in modern white people, which were, you know, these people would have been kind of white as well. So it's like less than 1% per 100,000, so that puts it into the rare disease category. It's an inherited autosomal dominant condition of unchondral bone growth. And some of the sort of the features of it are things like disproportionate short stature, which we certainly identified in one of the two men. Skeleton 331 was kind of affected more severely than skeleton 197. Limb length discrepancies, again, he had this. Forearm deformities, he had the sort of Madelung deformity of his left forearm. Coxavara, valgus deformities of knees and ankles, and he had them all. And shortening of the hand bones. So he had lots of the sort of typical characteristics. But the reason we noticed it first was because he had lots of these osteochondromas. So you can see here his tibia and fibula, and they're basically joined together by this kind of bulbous osteochondroma. So he also had the sort of the spur lesions. So this is a modern person, but so he had some of the spurs, but in his condition, it was more this kind of bulbous type lesions. Now, we've got four archaeological cases in Ireland, and that's kind of the biggest concentration, if you like, in the archaeological record. So I think that's very interesting because we know it's only in sort of isolated populations that you get any sort of deviation in frequency. So, for example, the Chamorros of Guam, there's 100 per 100,000 people affected. And then in a certain part of Canada, there's 1,310 per 100,000. So my suspicion is that this is, you know, part of our, again, kind of going back to our island nature. And it sort of suggests that there's sort of, you know, like the gene pool in this particular area, you know, had this condition. And this is something we're going to investigate with colleagues in Trinity College Dublin. Because what was interesting as well was that these two men, we assumed they'd be contemporary, but they were actually separated by a couple of hundred years. So there's lots of interesting kind of genetic questions to ask about them. And this was just something I thought was interesting as well. You know, modern people with conditions like multiple osteochondromas seem to take a bit of heart from, you know, reading about people in the past with similar conditions. And this blog was written by a person with multiple osteochondromas, and he actually empathised quite a lot, you know, with our men from Ballyhanna. So I thought that was another thing that archaeologists can kind of contribute, that we don't really maybe appreciate, you know, that people with conditions are interested, you know, in finding out about other people with the conditions, and it's maybe even more interesting if they're from, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago. I just wanted to kind of, I'm nearly finished, just put forward this slide. Just basically, this is what the DNA can do. So DNA, like I say, DNA is really revolutionising what we do. So this is kind of a plot of our Ranala people onto like a profile with modern DNA. So you can see that most of them kind of fall on top of the Irish profile. So they're probably mostly local to Roscommon, although there were some from the north and some from Britain. But there was this woman here from kind of the Scandinavia area. So we think she was probably a Viking, but I'm not really going to go into that. But what I just wanted to explain was that, you know, a lot of the diseases that you guys would study are invisible in archaeological skeletons, but DNA is helping us to find them. So, for example, all of the individuals who had their genomes mapped, only one of them had lactose intolerance. So this was a woman. And again, you know, like, her life must have been quite miserable in a dairying economy, but we couldn't tell that from her skeleton. It was hidden in her DNA. And quite a number of the individuals carried hemochromatosis, which is, again, you know, it's called the Celtic disease, and it's the iron retention. And we found skeletons dating back to the Bronze Age with this condition, or with carrying this condition as well. So I think, again, it's all in terms of how disease has affected populations and evolved that we can kind of feed into these. We're on the quest for evidence of cystic fibrosis, but as yet we haven't found it. So that's kind of the end, and I just hope I've given you a little flavour of what we actually do as paleopathologists, you know, and we kind of want to move from the sort of the burial and the skeleton to actually trying to think about the people. And I always like this picture. This is a picture of Gaelic Irish people, but it's one of the rare sort of depictions where you actually get, you know, women, men and kids, because, you know, obviously these were the people who lived in the past, and, you know, I think it's important that we sort of talk about all of them.
Thank you very much. That was absolutely excellent. Any questions? Yes?
Thanks very much, Eileen. A fascinating lecture.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, what happens to the remains after they're, when they're building the road? Where do the remains end up?
Okay, well, So they're excavated, and then they would be taken back to like an archaeological company or to like the university. So then we would wash them and do all our analysis. And then these remains, they're sort of under the jurisdiction of the National Museum in Ireland, because the Irish legislation basically treats skeletons as archaeological objects. So it's to sort of protect them, but it means then they have to make the decision about, you know, do they get reburied or do they get curated and stored. So most medieval skeletons currently get curated. Now, there are issues with that because they do have, you know, warehouses full of thousands of skeletons. I don't know if you've heard about children's burial grounds, the little Killini. So, like, I've been involved in a number of analyses of remains from that type of site, and they're a bit more recent, and there's usually living relatives who can say, you know, my cousin's buried there. And they've been reburied. There's been, you know, quite a lot of big ceremonies, you know, where the babies are being put into consecrated ground, you know, and communities wanted them back. So it is a bit of a, it sort of depends, and it's like I say, it's sort of the authorities. Now the Armoy skeletons, that was a Church of Ireland excavation. So basically part of the licensing arrangement was that those individuals would be reburied as soon as the archaeologists had studied them. So, yeah. So it's a bit of a mix. Hems.
Yes.
Could you comment, Jay? Some of our family came from Monaghan, and they said that only the men were buried in one church. The wives and okay. Children were all buried somewhere else. But that might be something that is relevant. It might be a very old practice that only
absolutely.
The men of the line, as it were, were buried in one place, and then the women could be buried wherever you could find.
Well, no, it is. I mean, it is interesting because we do think there's something going on, like in terms of that demographic profile at Ranelagh. But just when you say that, like, it reminds me, like my mum grew up in Carrickmore, and there's near her where there was the Relig Naaman, the women's graveyard, Relig na Páistí, the children's, and Relig na Fir Gunta, the slain men. And I always sort of thought about that as being more to do with Killeeney. But do you know, I think it could be further back, you know, as well. So it's probably, there's a lot of continuity in practices that we don't really think about. But yeah, that's very interesting.
And the other thing is, I can't remember the name, but I had a very interesting talk some time ago from one of the doctors in Cork who said that about leprosy.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying that the places have been translated as Lumbrian, but if you look at the original Irish, it's M-E-H-I-R,
mm-hmm.
It's actually leprosy.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the places that are called Lumbrian were actually the leopard's name.
Yeah.
Leopard's name.
Well, that's it. I mean, that is another way we can kind of find diseases is by looking at place names. So even like Leopardstown, you know, in Dublin, and anything like Ballinalore, the town of the lepers, you know, so it's all part of that. And then it's the anglicisation of place names, you know.
I'm sure there's a place where the original name in Irish was at the top, and then a translation into English below,
mm-hmm.
and then a retranslation into Irish wrongly.
Oh, yeah. that happens too.
On the bottom road.
Yeah. But I suppose the only thing we have to sort of, like, I think, how would they have been certain about their diagnosis of leprosy? And quite often it was the priest who said this person had leprosy. So if you had somebody come covered in
psoriasis,
yeah, they're going to go, right, leprosy, get, you know, you're outcast, so, because they didn't want to catch it.
Seamus.
I was going to see all these cancers in the bones. As you pointed out, everyone died young and you nearly know cancer.
Yeah.
The woman of 35 with cancer,
mm-hmm.
she had very punched out little lesions.
Mm-hmm.
You'd almost wonder if something like a kidney cancer is more likely than a breast cancer. Because breast cancer might have quite diffuse in general.
Right.
And would be mixed lytic sclerotic. They wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I just wonder if the pattern fits breast cancer, might fit something else like kidney cancer, where it was very much...
I'm delighted to hear things like that,
you
know. Can you send me pictures or a reference or something? Okay, good stuff.
So, Dr. Webb.
I didn't know, it was a fascinating lecture.
Thank you.
It brings back memories of anatomy lecture.
Okay.
So building a new underground line in London,
mm-hmm.
and encountered many medieval remains. And the thing that surprised me was that the teeth of these people appeared to be remarkably good.
Mm-hmm.
Is that explained by the fact that sugar really didn't come into Europe until the discovery of the New World and the slave trade and the sugar plantations?
Well, we definitely, you definitely see like an increase, a sort of like a line going up, you know, from Neolithic times all the way through to post-medieval and sugar. But like quite a lot of the medieval people had pretty nasty teeth, you know, with caries. But I think it's to do with eating cereals, because, you know, the carbohydrates. And if you think about it, if they're eating lots of, like, sticky porridgey type food, and then it's sticking to their teeth and they're not taking it off, that would cause cavities. But you do get, I mean, some people have beautiful, fantastic teeth, and there's, you know, it's hard to believe they're 1,000 years old. But you do get some with really rotten teeth and abscesses. And I've even seen, like, a skeleton where the abscess kind of went through the nasal cavity. And then you could see newborn bone formation in around the skull. And I don't know whether it was, like, secondary meningitis or something that killed them. You know.
Thank you. You just raised so many interesting questions.
Okay.
I've really got a question that I should know the answer to.
Okay.
It's a modern question. It's about osteoarthritis. Because you said about lack of cancer because people didn't live as long.
Mm.
Yet there was this large amount of osteoarthritis. And of course now we tend to think of osteoarthritis as a disease of later age.
Mm-hmm.
But here it was the lifestyle. And do we see the same thing in modern populations in primitive areas? I don't know.
I don't know.
People in non-industrial areas in the world who would have a similar heavy lifestyle, do they have a lot of osteoarthritis at a young age?
I don't know. I would presume they do, but I don't know. I suppose we'd have to look at, I don't know, India and places. But then is it recorded? Because it's... Google it, yeah. but I don't know whether, and then, I mean, like, because we're looking at the bones, you know, and we may say something looks really severe, but it mightn't actually been painful, because isn't this one of the things that clinically it mightn't look too bad in the bones, but it actually was really painful and vice versa. So I don't know if that would confuse things. It's just whenever we find things like the Schmorl's nodes, you know, the indentations, like we do find those quite a lot in teenagers especially, you know. So, but that's a good question. It's made me think as well.
What's the sort of time span in Ranelagh? Because you're talking about some event possibly happening, yeah. But presumably these remains are from a long period of time.
Yeah, I mean, because this is still in progress, we're kind of waiting for kind of the final sort of archaeological, sort of the final kind of chronology and different things. So that's kind of it's a bit of a work in progress, that. But I mean, that was just a couple of examples. The annals do talk quite a lot about, you know, poor weather events. And then we know that there were a lot of volcanic eruptions and it affected the sky and the quality of light and different things.
Peter?
Thanks very much. Very interesting lecture. I just had a question about the orientation of the why were they pointing towards the west?
So the head's to the west so that you can face the east for kind of the resurrection.
Okay.
So that's it.
But in prior to Christian times, there's orientations in burials as well. So is there something deeper than that?
I don't know. I've seen burials like the Russian populations I've studied, you know, the orientation's totally different, you know, and it's totally different, like it's shamanistic in all religions. But even like in Christian cemeteries, like I didn't go into this at all, but you do get people who are orientated different ways, and there seems to be, sometimes it's sort of like a deliberate selection, you know, to treat people a bit differently, and then you get people with flexed legs, and a lot of children seem to be buried on their sides, and you get kids with pillow stones, and I think it's kind of, again, their families probably did more of burying than priests, so there's more personal touches put into graves. But the west, that the head to the west is sort of the dominant.
Seamus?
Does the church at the moment bury the priests facing the opposite direction? Did you finally turn in the opposite direction?
Well, the current
Catholic practice, yeah. The priests are facing the opposite direction.
But I think we've probably, ours wouldn't be all males, you know, that are in the unusual orientations. But there's something, I just think people did things deliberately. You know, it's very rare that you'd find like a random occurrence in something like burial, which is so emotive, you know. And
Stanley.
I remember the first lecture of the Belfast Medical Students Association that I was at, and it was in 1966.
Right.
It was given by Dr. Gavin.
who was it?
It was given by Dr. Gavin Boyd.
Okay.
His topic was on the delivery of babies to women in Belfast who had rickety pelvises.
Oh, wow, gosh.
And I'm not relying on my memory because we have archives of that meeting still in the Royal, and I looked at it recently just to check that my memory was correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember he got a lady that he delivered several babies from by cesarean section,
mm-hmm.
and he got her with the assistance of his sister to get up on a chair and then up on a table, raise her skirts so that we could see her rickety legs.
Oh my goodness.
So and that is all recorded.
Yeah.
So I'm not relying entirely on my memories.
Well, that's what, you know, the consensus is, that probably any sort of anybody who had rickets or whatever, like a lot of the obstetric complications would have been due to the pelvic deformities. There's one case of multiple osteochondromas. We've got a medieval skeleton from Visby in Gotland, and she was pregnant and she had pelvic deformity, you know, the osteochondromas in her pelvis, and we think that's why the baby died, and the baby had the little tiny osteochondromas.
And the rickety pelvis of a rickety lady was soft, and it, rather than being oval-shaped, was deformed almost like a shamrock shape.
Right.
So that's the way
it's
it was.
Be, yeah.
And so they had to be delivered by cesarean section, or mm-hmm. else the ladies died with obstructed labour.
Mm-hmm.
Joel?
Yeah,
so two questions. One, okay. You talk about ear muffs, but it didn't look warm and cosy with the stones.
No. So what are they? They were stones, yeah. Again, I think we don't quite understand them, but the simple explanation that we put forward is to keep the face in the right place, to keep the head secure. But you get them with children, you get them with adults, but they're a minority, you know, and it's why did some people get these and other people not, you know.
And the other thing I have to say, and seeing the number of patients. When you said there was something 1,300 skeletons in one cell, I instantly thought, how long is that going to take you?
Yeah.
So how long would it take to process each skeleton?
Okay, well, I mean, these are team efforts. So, for example, so Ballyhanna, I had a PhD student, and she and another couple of people actually worked through the adults, and then I focused mostly on the children. But it depends, you know, if you've got a skeleton with no lesions, you can take an hour. It's very quick. But if you've got a skeleton, like that multiple osteochondroma skeleton, we could be recording him, you know, for a week. It just depends. And preservation, you know, with a lot of children's skeletons, you just get little scraps, so there's only so much you can record. So it depends.
Sorry, I've been in medicine a few years, but this operation at the top of the head, trepanation, can you tell me something about that, please?
Trepanation. Because I think you still do it. If somebody's got pressure or hemorrhage or something, don't they get a plate?
Burr holes. The last time I did that was in the matter of casualty in 1981 when somebody had been hit by a plastic bullet on the head. And you had to get the blood out quick. But I think yours was done, it was done in medieval times, a bit like bloodletting, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, the hypothesis is that it could have been for therapeutic reasons. So if somebody even had a condition like epilepsy, it might have been interpreted as possession. And I've come across a Ukrainian skull, and the person, I think they were genetically deaf because the auditory canals were completely filled in with bone. You know, I think the canal wasn't formed, and she had been trepanned. And I wonder, was her head all muffled, and they were trying to alleviate? And then sometimes we find like skeletons with a head fracture, you know, a cranial fracture, and they've trepanned. So again, it could be like a hemorrhage or
that
releasing.
Might be life saving.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've got Mesolithic examples. We've got so many examples, but it's interesting that it's the more recent people who had less chance of survival because the drill, you know, and then they pop kind of into the brain.
Yeah, they get in through the meninges.
Yeah.
Your interesting point at the start about Ballyhanna being lost. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a graveyard with 1,300 people. There has to be some deliberate element to cover it over, do you think?
Yes. We think, because it's at Rockview House, I think it was all to do with when the land was sort of taken off the church and it became kind of part of the plantation sort of era things and changes of religion. So it went from being like a Catholic Erina to like a Church of Ireland as part of that estate. And then there was a big house built. And there's sort of some suspicious stones around the wall of the big house that looked like they might have come from a church. So it could have been that it was part of that sort of change of ownership of the land. And it was obliterated, you know, it was sort of nobody's allowed to bury there, and it's flattened, and so there's been a few examples of that have been sort of explained that way. It seems to make sense, you know.
Bernard, something you mentioned at the very beginning, where you said about domestic habitation, people living within the graveyard area.
Yeah.
Was that they actually lived? How close was that to the body?
So there would have been, I don't have a picture here, but it's like a you've seen raths out in the countryside, you know, like the earthworks. So these are bigger scale sites, but they're kind of, there's sort of ditched areas and surrounded by banks. So it's like one section of the site, you know, would have been for the dead and then the rest for the living. I don't know how to describe. So like over here for the living and then the cemetery kind of kept. Yeah. That's exactly. It was like a pizza slice. But I mean, this is the other thing, because we're waiting for the archaeological, like the more general sort of site information. It'll be interesting just to see, you know, was the site abandoned, you know, and that's why I've got the wedge, or was there periods when they had a small area for the dead, and then it's, you know, so the two may not have been exactly contemporary all the time. So, but that's what we're sort of waiting for at the moment.
Okay, well, that was a fascinating discussion, and thank you very much. So I think we can continue the discussion downstairs over a cup of tea and a bun. So thank you very much.
Thank you.